Hey team, welcome to another episode of the Intentional Agribusiness Leader Podcast, the podcast where we actually explore the minds of leaders from all around the agriculture and agribusiness space about what it takes to lead intentionally in this industry today. My friends, if there's some value in here for you today, we ask you to subscribe to the podcast, share this with someone who needs to hear the message of what it takes to be intentional. Let's get into the show. Hey team, welcome back to another great episode of the Intentional Agribusiness Leader Podcast. This is your host, Mark Jewell. And today I'm on here with Mark Stewart with AFA, which I'm excited to learn more about. I have not been a part of AFA or been to an event, but I have followed it. I have plenty of friends that have been active in it as student leaders and as supporters in their adult life. So I know you guys do a lot of good for the industry. So excited to learn more about that. But welcome to the show, Mark.
Appreciate it. Thank you much for the opportunity, Mark. And we'll have to change that. We'll get you involved sometime this year.
That's okay. Yeah, I said it. Now it's going to happen, right?
It's going to happen. Let me write it down.
Let's get into the opening question. What's it mean for you, Mark, to be intentional?
Yeah, so I know you get a different answer to this question every time you ask it. So mm-hmm. I love that. For me, I think it just, there is meaning behind your action. Like it's an action-oriented sort of concept and there is specific meaning behind it. Otherwise, it's hollow and meaningless. And so that can apply in business and in professional life, but you have to stay focused on it. And so I think, again, there's genuine meaning behind it. It's action oriented and you have some focus to it. And if you have the elements of all those things, that's intention. If you don't have, or you're missing elements of that. So for instance, you have great meaning behind it, but you don't take action on it and you don't stay focused on it, then it's hollow and it's not intentional. And so, and again, I've reflected on my application in business and in life. And when you lose focus or you lose the action oriented, you don't stay on top of it, then you're not being intentional. And that happens pretty easily. We get distracted. Life happens. Yeah. Great ideas come along. They take you on a different path, et cetera, et cetera.
And, right.
But yeah.
100%, man. We're trying to solve for that with this podcast and other resources that we produce as well. This is where we find a lot of people in different stages of life, but especially, you know, guys that get to kind of our age and stage of the career, you know, hit that mid-40s and start looking around and say, is this all there is? Like, is, you know, like I'm pretty good at what I do, but I'm not really living, you know, mm-hmm. like you gotta help people find meaning in everything that they're doing.
Yep.
Yeah, well, yeah, talk to us a little bit about AFA, what you guys do, who you serve, how you serve. I want to dive in, spend 5 or 10 minutes just kind of prying this apart, because I know that you guys do a lot for the ag industry in the way of developing future leaders, new leaders, et cetera. And you've put out a lot of great talent, a lot of people that are probably listening to this that are in those leadership roles now. And so let's do it justice and talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, we'll try to keep it brief, but I appreciate the opportunity. I mean, essentially, we're in the human capital business. So, you know, we're working with undergraduate college talent predominantly. We do some work in the young professional space, but the core of what we do is really three things. We create environments where one can enhance their network, which is both peer-to-peer and like student to professional. These environments also focus on competencies, soft skills, life skills, whatever you want to call them. That's the core of the training that we provide. And the third aspect of it is all around career exploration. So all of those three things happen in some form or fashion in all of our environments. And we've got a set of principles that we live by. You know, we value young people as leaders of our organization. We believe learning is a lifelong process. Your network is a personal asset to you, as valuable as anything else you'll ever own. So there's a kind of a set of guiding principles that kind of help us shape work. But the unique thing about us, Mark, candidly, is that what you know about other youth organizations, you have to throw out the window, because we're not structured the same. There is no formal membership. There is no campus or club structure to it. We're built to kind of mirror real life. One has to apply and be selected for an environment like ours. Don't hear me wrong. It's not exclusive. It's not that way. But people that are engaged with us are doing it intentionally. There is an ambition and an interest, a genuine interest in their own personal growth and development as to why they would stick their neck out. And that's the fun part of it, is that's who we're working with, and you find great joy. And at the end of the day, we're just rising the tide. Again, we're helping grow the competencies of young people, building their network to be more eclectic than it would otherwise be, and helping provide a broader perspective to what's out there career-wise so that people make better and informed decisions. And if we do this well, we have strengthened the industry for the future. So I know that seems very theoretical, but without getting into the weeds of how we do it, that's essentially what we're after.
Well, it's a pretty good theory, because one of the challenges as also a human capital company serving agribusiness organizations, you know, generally most of our clients will be in the further along in their career. However, one of those big challenges that we're often having to help people understand is how to build your network before you need it. And we get a lot of salespeople that roll through our training and coaching programs that just don't have or haven't had the concept of building that social network, that professional network, the that personal board of directors, if you will, who can stand behind you, help you make connections in order to do your job well, because that's most of it. And often we're just rolling in and it's like, now I need to go make a sale, and I realized, oh, I wish I had that relationship, but I don't, right? So I end up appearing maybe more desperate than I have to. There's not a lot of intention there, where intention behind that role would be, hey, let's be a part of the community, network, integrate, give back, right? Make your tithe. I mean, do all the things that integrate you so that you've got that reputation, that network, that supportive network before you have to go ask for anything. My belief is that if I can put, and this is one of the reasons we do the podcast as well, if I can put more value into the industry than I ever take out, I'll never go hungry. My business will do fine.
Mm-hmm.
And you've
strengthened the industry. Yep. We're essentially after the same thing. And speaking from the same, same book, interesting. We talk about intention. You talked about building the network for when you need it. There is building, and then there's leveraging the network.
And
if you think about it in the way that I was trying to think about intention, there's meaning behind it. So you're doing it for a purpose. There's an action to it, and you have to be focused in the way that you do that. And so, for instance, when I talk to young people today, I talk about at least the way that I've gone about it, and not really thinking about it. Nobody ever really trained me or exposed me to this. I was not as ambitious as the young people we served in college when I was there. Mm-hmm. However, somehow I learned this thing early on. And so, I would maintain relationships well beyond my working with an individual, never knowing where that might go. And so the way it may look is, I may be driving down the highway, I see a billboard that reminds me of somebody, and I just send them a note, and I don't need anything from them then. I don't want the time that I reach out to my network to be the time that I need something from them, but there's a meaning behind it. There's some action. And if you stay focused on that throughout the course of your life, not only have you built the network, but you then can leverage it in meaningful ways. And I think the power of the way we talk about it, Mark, is, again, I use the word eclectic, bringing a very diverse, broad group of young people together to learn and grow and connect together. I believe that helps break down some barriers and some walls and some silos down the road. And if we do this right over the long term, the young people that we're serving will have kind of this rich, eclectic network that won't be so siloed and shallow in their thinking and sort of guarded in their work, that hopefully we can figure out how to agree to disagree and have candor and solve problems together, even though we may not agree on issues, like a lot of the things that we're facing in life today in society.
Right.
If we do this right, we're talking about this in food, ag, natural resources industries, but hopefully the rising tide lifts all the boats. And so this could happen in the communities that they live and work in. Obviously it should happen in the industry, but hopefully we can have a ripple effect.
Yeah.
So yeah, anyways.
Fantastic. Well, we'll keep going. I mean, there's such a need for people that are equipped with these skill sets and mindsets once they get under the hood of any organization, but they're going to be faced with different types of cultures, maybe not always great cultures. Often we get brought in to solve for toxicity within a culture because it hasn't been curated intentionally over time. And so now you're left with what is just there right? And so you need people that can think outside the box, that know how to have open dialogue and debate. We can agree, or we can disagree, but still work together professionally and come to a conclusion or a compromise and move forward. And so those are amazing skill sets, and obviously things that people need. And I love the focus on lifelong learning, because the need to develop that skill never goes away. So you mentioned not having chapter organizations within the universities and those kind of things. So how do people get engaged at first? How do young people get engaged with AFA?
Yeah, so we've grown. We're only 27 years old as an organization, but we've grown primarily by word of mouth. Now we're trying to be much more proactive in our outreach, to speak to different audiences that don't know about our opportunities and such. But you have a great experience. Mm-hmm. You tell others about it. That's generally how a lot of business works. So you think about Net Promoter Score. That's something that we measure our success by. A lot of industry does. It's basically a measure of word of mouth. And so as a matter of perspective, you're shaking your head, you know, NPS. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
For those that don't, you can score from -100 to 100. And you basically take your promoters, your 9s and 10s on a 10-point scale. You've gotten the surveys from Southwest Airlines or whomever. Mm-hmm. On a scale of 0 to 10, how likely are you to recommend us to a friend or a colleague? You have to have had some interaction with that organization in the last year. It's got to be current. And again, your score is -100 to 100. We have had this year scores anywhere from 60 to 100. Mm-hmm. Literally, we had an experience that had a perfect NPS. And so, you know, that's a off on a tangent, but that's a big deal. When people will promote you, that helps tremendously. And so we relied a lot on that over time. We rely on liaisons on college campuses to put the word out to students, undergraduate students that are looking to grow themselves professionally. We do need a little bit of support either from them or the student, because to get engaged with us, you have to get to the experience. Our partners cover everything else. So there's got to be a little bit of the skin in the game.
Sure.
But definitely universities will help in that regard. And then we've got a small army of student leaders all across the country. So we've got 50 formal student leadership positions today.
Wow.
40 of those are ambassadors of ours. So again, kind of boots on the ground marketers telling about these opportunities that we provide and why someone might want to take the time to invest in themselves. And so that's the way we've really tried to kind of grow and scale, is by letting others share their personal stories. And it's been pretty powerful.
Yeah, that's very powerful. If you've been in it for 27 years and still maintaining and still adding value to the industry and have an NPS that is that high, then obviously you guys are doing something really, really well.
Yeah.
Good. Good for you. Well, let's get into some of the other questions. I want to give you a chance to share some of your wisdom. I'm also interested to see, you know, how does this work in the nonprofit world and your role as a CEO of a nonprofit? What are you seeing with some of the organizations that you guys are serving? Like, we could easily go hours. We'll give what we can today, and maybe we'll get to do a follow-up at some point. But as you know, a lot of ag industry organizations struggle with talent attraction, struggle with talent retention. I'm curious how that shows up inside your organization. And then the second part to that, the follow-up, is how are you guys helping, you know, some of those organizations that you serve to try and do a better job of attracting some of the young talent that you get to have inside your programs?
Yeah. So I'll kind of waffle back and forth on this. Part of my desire maybe to share even organizationally how we're trying to do this. It's not perfect. We only have so much upward mobility as a smaller nonprofit. However, we do sit in a unique position in that we're kind of smack dab in the middle of academia, industry, and young talent. And so we hear and see and observe all sorts of perspectives. So the first way that I would react to that is, on one hand, we have a little bit of thought leadership that we can share. Okay, so let's take Gen Z as an example, right? So college students coming out today, part of Gen Z, Gen Alpha after that, just helping industry partners understand the perspective of a young person today, so that they're not always rolling their eyes at, oh, this young kid just doesn't want to work hard. All they want to do is, you know, work from home or whatever. And so, like, help industry challenge those perspectives. So that would be one thing, just sharing out the perspective of young people in a kind of a broad way. Another more tangible way that we would help industry partners in some way is we do connect them with students. We provide avenues where that happens. We give them sort of a playbook for how to engage well with college students based on the student's perspective and our own perspective. So in other words, you're coming into this AFA environment. This is the best way to stand out. And we give some suggestions and advice. At the end of the day, the partner has to carry it out. And so what'll happen inevitably is pretty soon you'll see the true colors of a partner based on what their follow-up actions and interactions with college students are, and even how they show up in an environment. And some organizations do that really well, just like they invest in culture intentionally, and others not so well, but they go about their business their own way and they're convicted in that. And we don't say that's right or wrong. We just kind of observe and try to share out best practices and perspectives of young people as best we can. And so that's kind of the fun part of it. The way it looks, you know, internally for us as it relates to, you know, kind of retaining talent, I kind of think about it. We've done a lot of work in the last two to three years. You know, as it relates to culture, the way sort of the investment that I've made in it is first shift to listen. And so, again, I have the luxury of I met with every staff member 2 summers ago. And I really kind of asked, well, let me back up. I leaned on some professionals that were in my network that do this kind of work and said, here's what I'm thinking. I think it's time to take a pulse on our organization, you know, give me some advice and whatnot. And so it really synthesized it for me into kind of two questions. One, as it relates to workplace culture, what are we permitting? And what are we promoting? In other words, what are we allowing to happen, and what are we actually celebrating as it relates to the way we do our work? The other question was really all about what frustrates us in our day-to-day work. And so same questions for everybody. And, you know, I got a little bit of exposure to qualitative research in my education. And so that's all it is. You're looking for common themes. Yeah. And then whittle it down to 6, 7, 8 themes, met with my leadership, identified things that we wanted to build into our culture, but I didn't want them to be sort of the typical values that everybody talks about. And they didn't have to be one word. They just had to make sense. And then the final thing is I wanted them to be action oriented. So back to intention, I felt very important that it should be action oriented. And so we came up with a set of what we call lived behaviors. And so some people might call those values, but it started with, again, kind of the intention to kind of understand. We look at it from the perspective of what can be action oriented. And so the final piece of this is like how you live it out. So we start meetings, we talk about our behaviors, we celebrate those. So what you would call shout outs, you know, they're generally behavioral based. And and then the final stage in the process is, you know, obviously that has to live out repetitively so that it shows that you really mean it. And then we've implemented things like stay interviews with all of our employees. And I was at a conference not that long ago, actually, I think it was this time last year. And in a room of at least 200 industry professionals, a lot of them in HR, and the keynoter that was doing the session asked the room, how many of you are doing stay interviews? And I think ours may have been one of less than a dozen hands that went up, which was shocking to me, which is the whole notion is you find out what people are disgruntled about before they walk out the door. It's the opposite of an exit interview. For those that aren't aware, and it's not hard. We just, went out and looked at some resources. My colleague, my COO, put together a guide that we use. It's 5 or 6 questions that everybody asks. And you just ask the question, you sit there and you listen, and then you figure out, okay, what are we going to do with this information?
Hey team, please forgive this quick intrusion into the podcast, but I have a really important announcement that I want everybody to get their earballs on. And that is that we have an upcoming Thriving Leader event coming up August 21st and 22nd. The Thriving Leader is our flagship program. We have run this thing over 135 times across the broad scope of agriculture. Thousands of people have gone through this and our coaching programs, and our public events each year are free. We only run two of these per year because of that. And your next chance to get access is coming up on August 21 and 22. The next one will not be until 2025. So we hope to see you. It's in Kansas City. Head on over to thriving-leader.com. That's thriving-leader.com. You get all the details and to book a meeting to see how you can get free access for you and some of your team coming up at the Thriving Leader in Kansas City, Missouri, August 21st and 22nd, 2024. We'll see you there. You know, we're talking about stay interviews, which I think is a fascinating concept for many because almost nobody is doing them. As you mentioned, you guys are one of the few at this event that are actually performing them. How simple of a concept that, and how intentional of a concept, because it's circumventing some of those potential issues and helping you have a conversation that's not just a performance review, right? It's a real stay interview. So yeah, just tell us a little bit more about how you guys do them and, you know, what that process has been like.
Yeah, well, one of the most important keys is that you have to separate it from the performance review. Mm-hmm. So we do it at a totally different part of the year. But there's consistency in the process. So again, every supervisor is armed with the same guide, set of questions, potential sort of follow-up questions, probing questions, if you will. But the whole intent is not to react, not to respond, just to listen. And mm-hmm. And then the follow-up to that is, okay, what are we going to do with that information? And so we challenge our supervisors to think, you know, thoughtfully reflect on what it is you heard mm-hmm. and what it is that we can do about it. We certainly do have annual win-wins, we call them, that yep. are both professional work as well as your individual development. So we think about, okay, what is the connectivity to the person's win-win? And can we weave in some elements that we heard within the stay interview into that process? And if needed, think about a development plan. And the mm-hmm. development plan doesn't have to be an annual thing. A development plan can be, I hear you that you want to be here in 3 to 5 years. This is what the process could look like, and some benchmarks, mm-hmm. some timelines that we might want to create. And so, you know, we've done this for a couple of years. We're still relatively new at it. We're just, the way I would describe it, Mark, is as an organization that's in the human capital space, for all the things that we're promoting, we're hypocritical if we don't try to be as healthy yep. as an organization as we think others should be. And if we don't develop our own team. Now, again, we can't spend thousands for everybody to go to all these conferences and get master's degrees and all the other things, because we are right. a nonprofit when mindful of the resources that the industry bestows upon us. But that's kind of what it's rooted in, candidly. Yep. Again, we're a hypocrite if we don't try to do this well ourselves. And I'm sure there are team members, former team members of mine, that'll hear this and they'll think, why weren't we doing that when I was there? Or yeah, but right. because, you know, we stumble through this stuff, but we're trying, the intention is there. It's action oriented and we're trying to stay focused on getting better.
Right. Well, the word is intention, not perfection, by the way. Yeah. Yeah. So everybody is fully clear on that, right? Just because we're even well intended doesn't mean we're perfectly executed all the time either, right? I mean, it's to get back to the beginning of the interview, right? We're talking about the definition of intention having something to do with meaning. There's meaning behind what you're doing, and our brains are really meaning seeking machines. And as we mature, our brains will seek different types of meaning. And that's where growth comes from. That's where new ideas come from. That's where innovation comes from. And so, you know, intention is such an important part of all of that, you know, over time. So, but I appreciate you bringing that up. And I would love, you know, anybody who's listening that decides to try this to report back and reach out to me, and we'll bring you on for another interview. To talk about how, you know, like if you adopted this, like what went well, what didn't go well. It'd be cool to hear from somebody that actually takes this and runs with it. So, but Mark, in the course of your career, what's been a big hurdle, or maybe even the biggest hurdle that you've had to overcome?
The first thing that comes to mind is sort of embracing humility, and that seems really theoretical, but I'll give you a couple tangible examples. One way that humility has showed up to me as a hurdle is some of the best as I reflect back, some of the best opportunities that have happened to me professionally are a product of something I didn't get that I wanted, namely positions. I think at least two or three of the most significant milestones in my professional career are a product of that. So in the moment, you're like, this sucks. I can't believe that just happened. I really wanted this. And literally not long later, the door is open to something that you never even thought or saw coming. My being at AFA is one of those examples specifically. And it comes back to your network as an asset, and it'll call on you sometimes when you're not expecting it or needing it. A lady from my church who had been helping raise some money, we retired some debt. Apparently she thought highly of me, knew that my predecessor here was trying to find somebody to run the development part of the organization. I think we were five or six as a staff at the time. Anyways, yep. I'm in the state of Washington interviewing for a head job in an advancement shop at a university, which is where I thought I wanted to get back into higher education.
Yep.
And she calls me and she's like, hey, have you connected with Russ yet? And I said, no, but I love to network. Again, I wasn't lying. I'll definitely call him when I get back. And fast forward, the board thought I was a little too young for that role at the time. They didn't hire me. I had lunch with Russ, and I think a week later I was at AFA. And so you just never know. And that was not the first time. The time before that, the very first time it happened, I was passed over for a role that I had a ton of working experience with. They hired somebody that had an advanced degree over me, but not the working experience. And I had already committed to moving back and living there. All life lessons. I still needed a job. I had to work for the lady that they hired over me because I needed a job, and she never knew for the longest time. So although that is wrapped up in kind of humility, which is sort of, you know, learning how to lick your wounds and understand that there's got to be a reason for this. And in some cases, swallow your pride in the process. And it'll allow you to find the good in what's to come. Yeah. And I've heard a million of these stories, mainly from former board members of ours or partner execs that we've worked with that share these stories with young people. You just have to live some of them to really truly understand it. But like, those have been the hurdles sort of in my perspective that, you know, it's not about the day-to-day hurdles. It's more about the sort of life, career, journey hurdles. And most of that's wrapped up in, again, humility and learning to kind of swallow your pride when you need to and figure out what the greater meaning is in all of it.
Yeah. Well, cool story on how you ended up here and, you know, the all the things that have led us to greater levels of humility along the way are, you know, they're hurdles in that time frame, but man, that the humility now, you know, that turns into maturity.
Yeah.
Right. And it's certainly in the end worth the journey, not always comfortable when you're going through it.
So let me share another fun analogy here. And if you'll oblige me, I actually ran the hurdles. It's just, I ran the hurdles all the way through college.
Oh, wow.
And the thing about hurdles is, yeah, form and all that matters, but it's actually about how quickly you get back down on the ground, because you're wasting time in the air. That makes sense? Because you're not moving.
Yep.
So it's all about how you get up and down as quick as you can. And then you have to be fast in between too, but, and form is certainly important, but if your form sucks and you can get up and down really quickly, it doesn't really matter. So I think there's a lot of power in that analogy now that I'm thinking out loud here with you, because it's just like, how do you let that go and get moving again in a positive mindset after you've gotten over that hurdle? And I've never really thought about it that way, but I think that's kind of powerful.
Yeah, it really is. It's so much what we work with our coaching clients on is dealing with failure, dealing with rejection. You know, if you're in a sales role, like, just get used to the fact that 6 or 7 out of 10 times you're getting rejected. You know, 6 or 7 out of 10. You know, and I'm sitting here like, I got a big proposal sitting out there this week with a prospective client, like as we speak, and I don't know the outcome. I've done everything I can to try to, you know, win the deal, and at the end of the day they have to make a decision that's best for their business, you know.
And
it's the kind of deal that would allow me to do some things financially in the business this year that I wasn't planning on being able to do. So it's a cool one. And at the end of the day, like, my identity is not wrapped up in that deal, right? Like my professional performance isn't necessarily wrapped up in that deal. Would that deal help us? Could we help a lot of people with that deal? 100%. There's so much good that will come from this. And I give it 85% chance of closing. And at the same rate, like the 15% can creep in. You never know. Budgets get cut. Things get moved around. You know, somebody's having a bad day, decides to say no on the approval for that expense or whatever. You just never know, right? There's all these other things that can come in there. None of that has anything to do with me. Like, does it suck? Yep. Is it going to sting a little bit? Am I going to, you know, probably, you know, pound my desk a little bit if I get the no answer on that? Absolutely. But you know what? I'm still going to get up and go to work tomorrow.
Yeah. How quickly do you get back down on the ground and start sprinting again?
I love that. That's a great analogy. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. If I was a speaker who had run hurdles, I would absolutely make that one of my key cornerstone parts of my speech. So
I can't believe I've never made the connection. So I'm going
to
share it more often.
We're all getting to benefit from it today, Mark. That's good.
We were talking about perfection a little bit ago. I've got this quote literally on my desktop that I'm looking at right now. It's a Vince Lombardi quote, but it's like, you know, perfection is not attainable, but if we chase perfection, we can catch excellence. So, you know, just that we don't get wrapped up in this whole notion that even if we're going to implement stay interviews, you don't have to be perfect at it. But if you work really hard and, you know, again, there's intention behind it, there's a meaning, it's action oriented, and you're going to stay focused on it, there's repetition to it, then you'll be excellent, because eventually over time you'll learn from what didn't go well and you'll improve and go forward. But the intention has to be there.
So true. You know, I think one of the things that I would really love for more young people to really understand, more experienced people for that matter too, is half of the battle in being successful in your role is just staying in the game, right? Just keep running the hurdles. You just got to keep going. We get so impatient, you know, and I'll be honest, sometimes we're improperly incentivized, especially in the professional space. There's an unrealistic time frame in order to get to certain goals, and a business plan was built with certain timelines in mind, and those timelines are not always realistic. But by and large, you know, most of us, if you just stay in the game, you want to be a successful salesperson, relationship builder, you just got to stay in the game. You know, you want to be a successful team leader, you just got to stay in the game. You know, that's so much of it. And there are wins and losses along the way that, you know, during that time frame, of course. But I'm curious for you, Mark, what's been one of those big wins over the course of your career that you've, as long as you've been in the game?
It's a tough one to answer just because there's so many things that come to mind. Not meaning to sound conceited there, but candidly, I think, you know, some of the work that we've done here in the last few years at AFA is on the top of my list, which is I've never worked anywhere where I would say, you know, the organization was really intentional about culture the way we are here. And I've worked in a lot of higher ed, I've done some consulting, I've done some nonprofit work, not a lot of for-profit. It would be interesting to reflect on that, but I think there's a lot of relatability no matter the type of organization. And for instance, I had an old boss one time that had us read a book, thought that this was going to be okay, we're gonna lean into our culture here and our team development. Went out to dinner, barely even talked about the book, and never brought it up again. And so, and then you just go back to doing business day, you know, every day. There's no talk about how we want to behave and interact or what we're staying focused on. So all that to be said, again, this would be on the top of my list is, you know, I came into this organization, been very blessed. I think we've had a great run at it, but I wouldn't say we were always extremely, extremely focused on the kind of culture that we wanted and the way we wanted to act and interact with each other. And so I think that's important, especially because we spend so much of our lives at work, and you want people to be happy, fulfilled, and find great meaning in their work. And I think you can do that regardless of the setting. I think you were going to ask me about books. Can I jump us there?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's on the list, man. So if you got a good resource for us, we got to hear it.
I kind of thought about this in terms of authors, and this will be no surprise to people that know me very well, but I am a big Pat Lencioni fan, Patrick Lencioni. Yep. And one of the first books I was exposed to, which is probably where most people first got connected, was The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And that's great. Mm-hmm. One of the other ones that I actually stumbled upon later on, and I think I've read all of his books at this point, is when I got the book, it was actually The Five Signs of a Miserable Job, I think is the way it was titled. They've changed it now, and it's the truth about employee engagement. But I love the sort of the negativity of the way it was before. And I had to tell my boss, it's like, don't get any ideas. It's just, I like this author.
Yeah.
It's fable based, super simple. And I think extremely practical. That doesn't mean it's easy to do. However, in the book around employee engagement, Pat is all about people being happy, fulfilled in their work and finding great meaning. And it's kind of wrapped up in organizational health, which is everything that we're talking about here today.
Yep.
But in that book specifically, it's really three things. It's three signs. One is anonymity. This is sounds really simple, but like, do you know your employees? Do you care enough about them to like want to get to know them? It sounds super silly, but I think in a lot of cases, we have superficial relationships with our colleagues. And so do you actually want to know who it is you're working with? And then it goes to relevance. So as long as there's relevance to the job, connect what I'm doing to the greater meaning of the organization. And it doesn't matter if it's a not-for-profit or a for-profit. You can find meaning. You just have to connect the dots between what that person does day-to-day and what you're trying to achieve as a business. And then the third piece is around measurability. And the kicker here is the person that you know you're trying to lead has to be involved in defining the measure. So they have to get it. They have to want to connect to it, and then they have ownership of it. But you help them with that process because it has to make sense, right? Whatever they're doing day to day has to connect with the purpose of the business. So if you spend time, you know, there's not an anonymity, there's not an irrelevance, they can't see the connection, and there's not immeasurability, which is we can't figure out how to measure it.
Yep.
Then you can find engagement with an employee. And the fable that he uses in his book is about an Italian drive-through restaurant. And you can make a million parallels to the way that that fable plays out. So anyways, I got off on a tangent there, but
you know, no, I love it, man. So it was Lencioni, Patrick Lencioni. And the book is The Truth About Employee Engagement. Now?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Got it.
And the old one was The Three Signs of a Miserable Job. So the misery comes in they're like negative terms, irrelevance, anonymity, irrelevance, and immeasurability. But it's really at the end of the day, you know, we want to be engaged in the work we do. And so it's something that we track. In fact, we just had a report out to our staff of what our employee engagement score was this year. We track engagement of all of our leadership. So we have alumni leadership, student leadership, staff, board. All of them are tracked the same, and then we roll it up into a leadership engagement score that is I'm held accountable to our board.
Got it.
And we've even defined what it means to us. So it's you know your commitment and your contribution to a purpose that shows up as discretionary effort. Like I'm going to go above and beyond because I'm engaged in the work that we do. And so we lay out the definition and we track it on a year-to-year basis. So that came out as a win, you know, again, I hadn't really worked anywhere where we had this much intention about, again, day-to-day interactions and accountability and how we behave, as well as kind of tracking the difference that we're making and then talking about it, celebrating it, maybe even unpacking it when it's not as good as we want it to be. And so we come up with a three themes every year out of our surveys that we say we want to focus on or we're going to try to get better. It's messy. It's not perfect, but it's progress and it's rooted in purpose. You know, there's a purpose behind it.
Yep.
There's action and we try to stay focused. There's got to be some repetition to it.
I like it. Well, what I love about this interview and this conversation today, Mark, is people listen as we kind of bring this in for a landing here is, you know, here's a real story of, you know, an organization that's been around. It precedes you, predates you being a part of the organization. So you've come in and now over the last, how many years have you been in the role?
I've been in this role, I think about 8 years, been at the organization a little over 12.
Yeah. So less than half of the age of the organization. So, but you've been there long enough to kind of make it your own. And in that process, you've looked for ways to intentionally start to curate the culture in ways such as the stay interviews and looking, being open and honest and vulnerable with those net promoter scores and let your clients, you know, review you. and see how you're doing. And then these other things that you're doing in the way of actually doing an engagement score. And now all these things actually reflect on you. So you kind of put yourself on trial, so to speak, mm-hmm. as the leader. Very few organizations do that, are vulnerable. Very few leaders are vulnerable enough to do that. And most people just frankly don't take the time to go through the work, because there is work behind all these things. You have to sit down and have those conversations. You have to evaluate the data. There's time and intention that goes into that process. But you got an organization today, Mark, that's doing a great job, that's growing, that's continuing to serve the industry in very positive ways. And good for you, man. It's cool to hear the story. We have questions we didn't get to today that we need to make time for at another point.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. Can I touch on vulnerability real quick?
Please do.
Candidly, I would say a lot of this work started with vulnerability, which was, we all generally have a light bulb moment or an instinct that kicks in that says, I wonder if it's time to maybe reset a little bit. Mm-hmm. For me, it was, had a couple of people leave the organization. There wasn't anything glaring about that, but something in me said, I wonder if it's time to, spend a little time digging into mm-hmm. how we're doing and if anything we should do differently.
Yep.
And so that was a light bulb moment for me. And it started with, okay, I stepped into this role and what is culture? It's either by intention or it's by design. So you can either let it happen to you or you can design the way it looks. And I stepped into this role, and there's a danger in kind of internal succession in that if you don't think about it or focus on it, it'll just happen whether you like it or not. And so mm-hmm. I just realized I had that kind of vulnerable moment of I had spent a lot of time and energy thinking about the workplace and the kind of culture that we wanted to create. And so that prompted me to go mm-hmm. listen to our team, ask those two simple questions, create some common themes out of that, engage mm-hmm. my leadership in the discussion about what kind of workplace do we want to create and how do we frame this up and how do we make it action oriented and how do we live it out and how do we celebrate it, all of those things. And so we've been at it a couple of years, but I could even take you back 6 or 7 years. And it was the humility of, we had spent a lot of time diversifying the students that we serve, geographic diversity, ethnic diversity, gender, all the things, mm-hmm. made a lot of really good progress, started to have more and more issues. Cause again, you're bringing together people with a lot of different perspectives and beliefs
and
little issues popping up here and then. And it's that, oh shit moment, that light bulb moment where you're like, mm-hmm. We haven't prepared our organization and the leadership within our organization to figure out how to create these safe learning and environments. And it wasn't unsafe, like nobody was getting, physically harmed, but there's, emotional harm in the way you conduct business. And so that started us on a journey of how do we build, diverse, inclusive, and respectful kind of learning environments. Again, mm-hmm. done with intention, with a meaning. There's action behind it. We figured out how to measure some of this stuff and been on that journey 6-7 years or more, but started in a vulnerable place of, hey, I don't know what's going on here. We should figure out, and let's just be honest, we need to do better. Yep. And that can be a tough pill to swallow. I'm pretty comfortable with it just because I'm, mm-hmm. Wasn't ever the smartest person, wasn't ever the greatest athlete, whatever. And so like just admitting that but saying, I want to get better.
It takes some of that humility, right? And it takes some of that humility to know, hey, I see this being a problem. I don't know how to solve for it. And that's, I talk about this a little bit on the show here and there, where, what I wish people understood about people in leadership roles is that they're not in that role because they have it all figured out. Okay. It's their job to figure it out, but that's what makes them the leader. You have to be a little bit risk averse. You have to be kind of on the bleeding edge of being able to see challenges in the organizations and say, hey, I see some roadblocks that are either in the way of my people's success or are going to be. And maybe I don't have all the answers today, but I do need to step in front of those and go find a way. Right. Otherwise, we bottleneck the organization and that will have been my fault. So it's not that people in leadership roles have everything figured out. It's that they're willing to.
Yeah.
Right.
And admit that when they don't know the answer, like that can be the hardest part, is admitting that they don't know, or feeling comfortable enough to be open about that so that they can engage others in figuring it out together. And, you know, it's oftentimes I think what happens is when someone isn't willing to be vulnerable because they think it's going to be a sign of weakness or a lack of credibility or whatever, that's when things get worse. Right. And, and so anyways, I've studied enough and kind of heard and listened to enough that I think generally people are attracted to a more vulnerable person anyways, because it's authentic, like it's real, like we're not perfect individuals. And so I don't mind opening up about some of that stuff,
for sure,
personal and professional. I think it's helping.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Well, before we go, man, I know you, not only are you running a 20-person team, but that 20-person team serves a larger organization that influences probably another 100 people directly, and then a lot more indirectly. Plus you've got four kids at home and a spouse and all the things that come along with that and everything. So what do you do to keep your energy up and maximize your productivity?
Yeah. The thing that has helped me the most is working out. I'm a morning person, so I find if I can get up and go do that in the morning, it helps me. I remove all the barriers that I can to that. So I was an athlete all the way through college, kind of got burnt out, you know, started heading the other direction. You know, when you've just been all day, every day working out, you get sick of it. And I got to a point where I didn't want to have to create workouts. I didn't want to have to think about any of it. So for me, the way it looks is I pay more money than I should to subscribe to a place to work out, but I go there. I don't have to think about it. I remove the barrier of that. I literally lay my stuff out the night before so that I'm not having an objection when I wake up in the morning. But if I can get my butt out of bed and go work out, I always feel better taking on the day. So that's what's worked for me. I'm not as good at some of the other stuff. I know people like to get into meditation or, sabbaticals, time away, those sorts of things. But for me, always getting some exercise and getting my day going early has always helped me take on the day.
You bet. Awesome. Good stuff, man. I'm glad to hear you say it, because more people need to hear it. More people need to put that into practice. Good things, man. Mark, this has been a cool interview. There's a bunch of gold in here, you guys. If you didn't pick up on some of the key big learnings in this, there are at least three. You need to go back and give the last 45 minutes a listen and pull these out of there. Namely, stay interviews, taking a really good look at your culture. What's your net promoter score? What's your culture and your engagement score? Find a tool. There's plenty of tools out there to help you measure that stuff and get after it. So, Mark, thanks for being on.
You're doing great. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I hope today's episode brought you a great deal of value about what it takes to lead life and lead in this industry with intention. If you want to go deeper on the topic of leading with intention, I encourage you to head on over to intentionaltoolbox.com and get the 7 free tools that will help you to lead your life in all areas with a greater deal of intention. That's intentionaltoolbox.com. And finally, if this message resonated today, if there was something in here that you got value from, I promise you there's someone else in your life who also would get value from this. So please share the episode, share the podcast, and make sure that you subscribe.